This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The UN chief warns climate breakdown has begun. In this show, you hear underreported climate change, Antarctic extreme events, with lead author Martin Siegert from Imperial College London. Plus from Australia, Dr. Martin Eucher on the early start to the ozone hole, what it means, and the Tongan volcano warming the world for years to come. It is Breaking Science from Radio EcoShock. Welcome. As record heat, fires, and storms rock the Northern Hemisphere, is there anywhere on Earth untouched by climate change? We are going where media does not, to the distant South Pole and the high stratosphere, seeking answers. Scientists thought, we all thought, the great glaciers of Antarctica were outside the climate fray, likely for thousands of years. Even leaders in the field are now changing their views. It turns out the seventh continent, cold home to ice miles thick, is not stable at all. In every aspect, from the deep glaciers through massive ice shelves to the sea ice, it's all been destabilized. As you know, sea ice around Antarctica has plummeted to record low volumes not seen in our times. Even the best glaciologists do not know why. They are convening meetings, conferences, and studies trying to find out. The area of sea ice lost is about the same size as the country of Argentina. Imagine, in a desperate attempt to stall global warming, humans covered up all of Argentina with mirrors to reflect the sun's energy back to space. By the way, massive mirror farms to help balance planet energy is a real thing. The Mirror Project, spelled M-E-E-R, is working it out. In our December 2020 show, Brent Ragsdale interviewed scientist and engineer Yi Tao from Harvard about the mirror geoengineering idea. So in our imaginary mirror covering Argentina, there is an unexplained breakdown. The surface on all the mirrors degrades, leaving a dark base that absorbs solar energy instead. The giant mirrors break down, and Earth absorbs more heat instead of cooling us. What an accident, what a tragedy, and that is exactly what just happened in recent years around Antarctica. Vast fields of bright white ice, acting as solar reflectors, melted away to reveal a dark ocean surface below. Not reported much in the media and unknown to the general public, we just went through a kind of geophysical change around the South Pole that adds energy greater than a million nuclear explosions to the world's ocean every day, every year. The big loss of sea ice around Antarctica is just another factor heating the world's oceans, destabilizing weather, stoking rapid intense hurricane buildup or typhoons, and pushing heat waves onto the land. I'm Alex Smith. Let's get the straight news from top scientists here on Radio EcoShock.
A clear lesson from the geological record is one of dynamism, which reveals that the Antarctic ice sheet is not a static giant frozen in time, but rather that it responds sporadically and unpredictably to large-scale environmental change. A lesson we should learn as Antarctica's environment is changed further because of fossil fuel burning.
Extreme weather events are reported all over the world. Can they hit Antarctica as well? Did you know the biggest recorded heat wave, as a sudden rise in temperature, happened near the South Pole? How fragile is Antarctica? We have first answers in a new paper titled Antarctic Extreme Events. The lead author is Dr. Martin Siegert, professor at Grantham Institute for Climate Change and Imperial College London. He is a glaciologist and world-recognized Antarctic scholar. From the UK, Martin Siegert, welcome to Radio EcoShock. Even a dozen years ago, Martin, many ice experts discounted most of Antarctica from any serious change in the next 1,000 years. Now we have to toss out those old assumptions?
Yeah, I think I'd probably count myself among those glaciologists that maybe by 2010 we were thinking that the Antarctic ice sheet was this amazing place full of interesting things to discover, of course, fascinating from the perspective of it being a region isolated from the rest of the planet, captured in time, sort of unchanged, largely for at least 14 million years. And that was the sort of evidence that we were coming to terms with from what we could gather. But, of course, that's not the case now. We've learned from the geological record, but also from events that are happening right now, right in front of us, that, in fact, Antarctica is subject to a lot of change, a lot of extreme things occur in Antarctica that we've been surprised about. And, unfortunately, some of those things are very much linked to wider global heating issues relating to the burning of fossil fuels.
I know this summer European cities went from cold to punishing heat, and then some streets turned to instant rivers in record rain. Can such rapid changes happen in the cold house we find at the Southern Pole?
Yeah, well, they have been. Of course, we've become accustomed to, sadly, to extreme events, and we've seen those all over the world. There doesn't seem to be any place that humans inhabit that isn't subject to extreme weather conditions one way or another, and that can manifest as droughts, it can manifest as extreme heating conditions, and that can lead to wildfires. We've seen extreme flooding events, often over areas of land that are already dry, and so you get huge flash flooding that occurs as a result. And all those things, sadly, contribute to the loss of livelihoods, and very sadly, to the loss of lives. And it doesn't really matter if you're in the developed countries or a country that has got a fully developed and rich economy, this is still affecting people's lives and livelihoods, and we should be very concerned about it. The question we put to ourselves was, is Antarctica subject to extreme events as well? And the most obvious extreme events are weather events, not alone weather events. There are other events that occur in Antarctica that we'd like to capture in our understanding of extreme things that happen in Antarctica. But, of course, the world's largest ever heat wave happened in March in 2022, where the temperatures in East Antarctica, that should have been something like minus 50 degrees centigrade, turned out to be more like minus 10 degrees centigrade. It's a jump above the norm of about 38 degrees centigrade, which is utterly unheard of. We've had some very hot weather in Europe this year, and, of course, last year in London, for the first time ever, and in many other parts of the United Kingdom, the temperature rose above 40 degrees centigrade. Now that will be a shift from the normal midsummer of about 17 degrees, usually about 23 degrees. So getting to 40 is about 17 degrees. Well, you know, 38 degrees temperature shift in Antarctica is phenomenal. If we'd have had something like that in London, it would have been 60 degrees centigrade, which, of course, would have been colossal. So yes, Antarctica is subject to extreme conditions. These are things that we hadn't noticed before, not because we hadn't been looking, but because they hadn't been occurring. And so we're deeply concerned about that. There are some other things which are not necessarily weather-induced, but are definitely global heating-induced, and that is, right at this moment, the extreme loss of Antarctic sea ice that should be growing around this time of year. It's in winter in Antarctica, and throughout this winter in Antarctica, the sea ice in many places just hasn't been forming in ways which we've never seen before. The lowest ever recorded sea ice growth phase in Antarctica, with potentially significant consequences for the rest of the planet.
What are some of those consequences? Why does it matter if the sea ice plunges around Antarctica? I mean, it doesn't directly add to sea level rise.
Absolutely. It contributes nothing directly to sea level. But there are a couple of things we are deeply concerned about, one of which does relate to sea level, which I'll come on to. But the first, if we look at the Arctic in the north, the sea ice there has been retreating fairly steadily since the 1970s. And what we've recorded in the Arctic is this replacement of a very bright reflecting surface, which is the snow and ice, by a very dark absorbing surface. So ordinarily, snow and ice, the solar radiation that beams down on it gets reflected back out into space. And so the Earth does not heat up as a consequence of having that snow and ice on its surface. But if it's not there anymore and it's replaced by a dark ocean or dark land, then the sun's radiation gets absorbed by the ocean or by the land, and further heating results. We've seen that in the Arctic, and which is why the Arctic region is warming at around about four times the rate of the rest of the planet. And So the Arctic is no longer acting to cool the planet. It's actually doing the reverse. It's accelerating warming on our planet. But the Antarctic hasn't been like that traditionally. So up until 2017, we've actually been seeing Antarctic sea ice grow, which has done us a wonderful sort of ecosystem favour by bouncing all that solar radiation back out into space. But since 2017, year on year, we've seen less and less sea ice. And what we're very concerned about is that the Antarctic is now starting to behave much like the Arctic has done for the last 30, 40, 50 years. And that is, we start losing the ice. The loss of ice leads to further warming because of the absorption of solar radiation, and that leads in turn to even less ice and so on. So there's a feedback process that results. If through time, so the next 10, 20 or so years, Antarctica really starts behaving like the Arctic and starts contributing to accelerated global warming, then neither of the polar regions will be acting in our favour to cool the planet, and both will be trying to heat it. And that's why there'll be an acceleration in global warming as a consequence of that process. So we're very concerned about that. The additional reason we're concerned is because of the knock-on consequence of heating in the Antarctic to the sustainability and survival of the massive slabs of ice which are floating around Antarctica that are formed by the grounded ice, the ice sheets. And those massive slabs of ice are called ice shelves. They act to essentially hold back the grounded ice from flowing into the ocean. Now, we know that some of these ice shelves have broken up catastrophically in the past, but there are many ice shelves around Antarctica that haven't yet disintegrated. But if they did, then we would see an acceleration of grounded ice flow from the continent into the ocean. You see, you don't need to melt the ice to cause sea level rise. All you need to do is to push it into the ocean, and under Archimedes' principle, it displaces its own weight in water, and the sea level goes up. You know, it can take 1,000 years to melt a big iceberg. It doesn't matter. Sea level has already happened instantly by virtue of it being in the water. So how does an ice shelf become unstable? Well, it can do that if the temperature, the ocean, and the atmospheric temperature around it starts to warm up. So losing Antarctic sea ice is bad for the planet in terms of accelerated global warming, but it could be really bad for the planet in terms of activating the Antarctic ice sheet to contribute much more to global sea level rise than it has done historically.
Well, speaking of feedback loops, strangely, one of the new worries addressed in your new paper is the impact of more land appearing as ice retreats. We would have thought that would be a good thing. How could that affect warming?
Well, for exactly the same reason. So if the land is covered by snow, then what will happen is that the solar radiation will be bounced back off it. But if that is exposing rock and soil, then that will heat up. The other reason that it's a concern is because of the occurrence of alien species to plants and maybe even insects in some parts of the northern part of the Antarctic Peninsula, being able to colonize that exposed land in ways that haven't been possible traditionally. And what we're really concerned about is some alien species being able to colonize the area much more quickly than the native species, simply by virtue of the native species not being particularly good at surviving warm conditions. And if you warm the Antarctic Peninsula up, it might be better suited to plants that at the moment don't normally survive in those regions. So there's another sort of ecological biodiversity issue.
A recent EcoShock guest explained part of Greenland was last exposed to sunlight around 400,000 years ago. When was the last time Antarctica had significant melting and ice loss?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So, you know, if you were asked me this question maybe 25, 30 years ago, there were two schools of thought, and they were completely opposing schools of thought. And there was a big debate in the scientific literature. One postulated that just 3 million years ago, in a period called the Pliocene, pretty much the whole of the ice was lost. It was all gone. And there was another side that said, oh, no, the Antarctic ice sheet has largely been unchanged for about the last at least 14 million years. And there was sort of evidence on both sides of this argument, probably more for the latter than the former, I should say. But there was some evidence for all of that. What we're beginning to learn now, as we appreciate the dynamism of the Antarctic ice sheet, is that you don't need to collapse the whole ice sheet to answer some of it, the questions that sort of former hypothesis had. And at the same time, it's just not right to consider Antarctica not changing at all, when it stands to reason that if the world's temperature changes, so would the Antarctic ice sheet. And what we've come to appreciate, and it's fairly settled now in the scientific literature, is that in the Pliocene, 3 million years ago, the Antarctic ice sheet in places was less big than it is at the moment, but was still there, persistent in some places and in many places. But the loss of Antarctic ice in the Pliocene 3 or so million years ago led to, occasionally, the sea level then being over 20 metres higher than it is today. And that's the enormous thing about the Antarctic ice sheet that we must be aware of. And, you know, I studied Antarctic ice sheet because it's very interesting and scientifically. But there's an important reason why society needs to understand it as well. And that is because it's a colossal store of water, ice, that currently lies above the level of the ocean. And as it melts and as it moves into the ocean, we will start to see global sea level rise. You know, there are 300,000 glaciers all around the planet, right, apart from Greenland and the Antarctic ice sheet. And if all those glaciers melted, but Greenland and Antarctic ice sheet didn't melt, then the global sea level that would occur would be somewhere between 25 to 30 centimetres. That's all it would be, which is bad, right, but that's all it would be. There's enough ice held in the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheet to raise sea level by over 60 metres. That'd be terrible, of course, and it would take thousands of years to do. But actually, you don't need 60 metres to cause us, our society, a problem. 1 meter will be really bad news. 5 meters will be a tragedy for many low-lying Pacific nations and ports and cities and things. And I've got to tell you that under a high level of warming, it is possible for the ice sheets, Greenland and Antarctica, to respond in this accelerated way such that by this century, we could have 1.5 meters, maybe 2 meters of sea level rise, and by the middle of next century, 3 to 5 meters of sea level rise. And that's if we don't stop burning fossil fuels. So we can do something about that now, take us away from a sort of strong warming future and save ourselves from this colossal problem. But if we don't do it, then we're stacking up problems for our children and those that come afterwards. Because once these ice sheets start to become dynamic, once they start to flow into the ocean, once they start to melt, there will be very little we can do to stop it.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Antarctic expert and Professor Martin Siegert. Your extreme study for Antarctica, it's not just about ice. Tell us about the perils you found encountered by living things in a changing Antarctica.
Yes, indeed. So we can talk about the sea ice as well. So sea ice is a very important substance for marine mammals, the seals and penguins and things. And if the sea ice starts to retreat, then that the habitat in which those animals can survive becomes less and less. So that's a bad thing. We can talk about as it starts to rain in Antarctica, and unfortunately, you know, 30 years ago, you would never be talking about raining in Antarctica, but it can happen now. And for chicks, penguin chicks, they've been evolved to never experience rain events, and their feathers just aren't equipped to be able to do it. So they survive with these fluffy feathers for pretty cold conditions, but dry conditions. And unfortunately, as it starts to rain, these chicks get wet. And if a cold event happens while they're still wet, then that wetness turns to ice, and these chicks will perish. And we're starting to see the loss of tens of thousands of penguin chicks as a consequence of rain events and warming, and as a consequence of the reduction in sea ice. So that's a deep concern. But, you know, it's nothing new. So that's a global warming issue and a burning of fossil fuels issue. But we can look back 100 or so years to another oil boom, and that wasn't oil and gas from the ground, but it was oil extracted from whales. And we virtually hunted humpback whales and blue whales to near extinction simply to try to get the oil from them. So humans and our fixation, we're completely hooked like a drug on oil, on fossil fuels now, but oil. And it's caused us to do awful things to our planet. Firstly, with the near extinction of very large marine mammals, northern whales, and more recently, the huge ecological and climate damage that we're doing at the moment. And we know if we stop whaling, as we stop whaling, those whale numbers came back, and that's great. It took a lot of time for that to happen. But it does tell us that once we stop and mend our ways and think about living on our planet in a sustainable way, things can be repaired, and that's what we're hoping with the climate problem as well.
Looking at new mechanisms in Greenland, we find the role of sudden ponds, torrents of water running deep into the glaciers, unexpected fragility to that whole massive ice structure. Do you see similar large-scale threats in ice stability in Antarctica?
Yeah, so we haven't at the moment. So in Greenland, you get these enormous ponds of water on the surface, and they find themselves through holes in the ice, and they get down to the bed of the ice sheet, and it can cause the base of the ice to become lubricated and to flow more quickly. And so that's been known about for some time. Quite a lot of research has been done on that. We've never seen that happen in Antarctica, but what we are starting to see is the ponding of water, much more than we had done some decades ago. And so the first element of Antarctica to becoming a little bit more like Greenland, we're starting to see that with the ponding of water. Of course, ice shelf disintegration, the floating slabs of ice that break up, can break up really quickly. That happens as a consequence of this process, and we've known that, and we've seen it on a number of ice shelves, large and small, all around the Antarctic continent, because of ponded water and that water finding its way down through the slab of ice to the water underneath. And once a hole gets punctured into the ice shelf, then the sort of structural integrity of the ice gets compromised. And as it happens repeatedly, then the whole ice shelf becomes useless as a way of maintaining itself and just breaks up catastrophically. So that's the process that we've known about. We can see it happening in some ice shelves, and there's been examples of it, and we're deeply concerned as more ice shelves get exposed to surface melting, that this can happen elsewhere in Antarctica.
One of the most frightening recent interviews on this program was about changes to ocean currents in the Southern Ocean and especially around Antarctica. That was with Dr. Matthew England. Was ocean change included in your study?
Yes, it was. We've seen marine heat waves happen in Antarctica. The problem with working in the ocean in Antarctica is a problem of data sparsity. You know, we just don't have an awful lot of measurements and observations. The Southern Ocean is vast. And we have some measurements, but nowhere near enough. There was a very good international arrangement of Southern Ocean observations, and that's fantastic, but we need an awful lot more. But we have had recorded evidence of multiple marine heat waves in Antarctica. Unlike the Arctic, the Antarctic Ocean, the Southern Ocean, is very mixed, it's very dynamic, and it's quite complicated to understand in a predictive kind of way. The Arctic is much more simple. You know, it's a pretty static ocean. There's not a lot of connection with it and the rest of the planet. But the Southern Ocean is very well coupled to ocean water elsewhere. And that's important because as the Southern Ocean changes, it can have an influence on the flow of water around the world, which is why as Antarctica changes, it impacts the Southern Ocean, and the impact of the Southern Ocean on ocean flows elsewhere will cause, of course, the transfer of heat around our planet to be changed, as Matt England would have told you about in your previous conversation.
Also on this program, Dr. Tim Lenton warned of cascading tipping points that could shift world climate in unexpected ways. What do we know about Antarctic tipping points, their proximity and potential risks?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I've had quite a few conversations with Tim and others about what we're seeing in Antarctica and whether those are actually tipping points, i.e. moving to a completely new state, or whether they are just positive feedbacks that we're starting to see. I mean, the positive feedback not being in a good sense, the positive feedback being in an accelerated, amplified sense. We are definitely seeing those. I'm not sure that we're quite ready to talk about Antarctica being tipped into a new regime quite yet.
And what did you and your 13 co-authors find as extreme interactions between the polar atmosphere and the ice?
Well, of course, an obvious one is a lack of ozone that we've known about for some time, and hopefully the repairing of that, the cover through carbons that were plentiful and used all the time in refrigeration systems. There was a ready, cheap replacement for those, and so the Madrid Protocol that banned the use of CFCs was so well received and effective because there was a ready alternative to it. So it just shows you what can be done if that alternative can be found. But of course, what we're seeing from an atmospheric sense is much more dynamism. And that heat wave that we were referring to earlier, 38 degrees, was a phenomenal event that happened in Antarctica. Usually what happens with weather systems is they wrap around clockwise around Antarctica by virtue of the polar vortex, very high atmospheric river of fast-flowing air, and also the orography of the continent itself. It's the highest continent by quite a long way on the planet, just because of the massive ice sheet that is, you know, in some places above 4 kilometres above sea level, and in many places above 2.5 kilometres above sea level. This kind of stops these storms from coming in. But what happened in March into 2022 was phenomenal. This jet, this river of atmospheric flows, essentially from Australia, ripping through and across the Southern Ocean and onto the Antarctic continent in ways we've just never seen before. And it was that very warm, moist air that caused the heat wave. And we're still trying to understand how that was possible, whether that was truly a complete freak, or because we're starting to see extreme events and in all realms in Antarctica right now, whether that too was associated with the burning of fossil fuels. And I think it's probably fair to argue at this stage that the fingers are pointing at global heating and the enhanced dynamism in our atmosphere as a consequence of that, which probably caused that heat event. In fact, there's a paper that's come out very recently that attributes that extreme event to the burning of fossil fuels.
Given the latest reports of fragile states at both poles, the 1 meter sea level rise by 2100 estimated by the IPCC sounds very low, very optimistic. If there is more, the risk to coastal cities and agricultural deltas could be catastrophic. After your review, what do you think?
Yeah, so in 2020, I and some colleagues wrote a paper about potential sea level rise in a preemptive investigation, because we were aware that the IPCC report was essentially saying those things, that about a meter, maximum of a meter by the century. Well, that is what is regarded as being an unlikely outcome, and that's likely in terms of the ice sheet response to global warming, but also the likely global warming that will result under different scenarios. And what we were very concerned about was what would happen to Greenland and Antarctica under extreme global warming, which, by the way, is the sort of track that we're on at the moment. And when you look at those extreme conditions, it turns out that the confidence that we have in sea level rise being about a meter by 2100 is around about 66%. So that means there's a 1 in 3 chance of it being outside of that range, and there's virtually no chance of it being less than like half a meter. So the 1 in 3 chance will be higher than 1 meter, and we wanted to point that out to everybody, because it might seem unlikely, but you can't discount it from happening, especially under a strong warming future, which, as I said, is like the track that we're on at the moment. Whether you believe or whether you want to understand that and accept it or not doesn't actually matter too much, because 2100 is just an arbitrary time. So we're worried about sea level rise, not necessarily just at 2100, because that's a bit of an arbitrary number. What we're worried about is the trajectory of sea level rise and where it's going. And in all scenarios, it keeps going up into next century and beyond. So it is possible for there to be at least 1 meter of sea level rise this century. It could be more. But by 2150, say, it'll be further sea level rise and maybe somewhere between 3 to 5 meters. And it keeps going after that. The problem is, this is a direct consequence of burning fossil fuels. And we are activating, mobilizing the Antarctic ice sheet and indeed the Greenland ice sheet to respond in this way. Once we activate it, once we provoke Antarctica and Greenland to start losing ice, it will be very difficult to stop it again. And so we are causing now massive problems for our future, for our children's future, and for many generations that come after them. We are behaving in a very irresponsible way for the future of our planet, and we're doing it knowingly and willingly, and we really must stop that, because we want to live on this planet in a healthy, happy way that allows us to fulfill our ambitions, but also we want our children and those that come after to be able to have the same privilege, and we're disallowing them from doing that right now because of the actions we're taking.
Yes, the study points again and again to fundamental questions we need answered, not about other planets, but one of the 7 great continents on this one. Martin Siegert, what would you tell governments, and what are you working on next?
Yes, so there are many things about Antarctica that's fascinating and we want to do. So one thing I really want to achieve for the benefit of climate science and our ability to predict sea level rise, much better than we are at the moment, is a systematic geophysical survey of the Greenland and the Antarctic ice sheets. You might imagine that we would have done that already. You know, we've systematically mapped the surface of Mars, for example, but we've never done that to the Antarctic ice sheet base. But that information is fundamental to models of ice sheet flow and therefore for prediction of global sea level. So it is something that is missing. We have a rudimentary understanding of what's underneath the ice, but not in an optimized way, optimized for the use of modeling. And so we urgently need that. And me and quite a few other people are starting to contemplate how we go about providing that survey and offering it to everybody, because it's urgently needed for future generations to understand how sea level is going to go up. But when I was speaking to decision makers and politicians, I stopped talking about global heating, because it feels, when you do that, that global warming and global heating is the cause. It isn't. The cause is burning fossil fuels, and we absolutely must transition to net zero as quickly as we possibly can by mid-century in the next 30 years. And then that gives us a chance. It gives us a chance to restricting global warming to 1.5 degrees, so that's another 0.3 degrees above where we are at the moment, and to maintaining the sanctity, the preservation of the Antarctic continent and the Greenland ice sheets, of course, in some way. Because if we don't do those things, then those ice sheets are lost. And for many generations after us, they'll feel the consequences.
From the Grantham Institute for Climate Change and Imperial College London, we've been speaking with Professor Martin Siegert. You can find links to the new paper, Antarctic Extreme Events. It's free access. It's in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Martin Siegert, thank you for sharing your time with our listeners.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
The Guardian headline reads, "Fears over Antarctic sea ice as yearly ozone hole forms very early." And what is all this talk about solar storms and climate change? Only a unique scientist could explain all that, and we have reached him. Dr. Martin Eucher trained in plasma physics in Switzerland, but now he lectures at the Climate Change Research Centre, University of New South Wales in Australia. Martin also serves as associate investigator at the ARC Centre for Excellence for Climate Extremes in Australia. He can be our doorway into these frontiers of science. From Sydney, Australia, Martin Eucher, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Well, just as an introduction, your original field, what is plasma physics?
Oh, that was all about generating energy with nuclear fusion rather than fission. To do that, you need a so-called plasma, which is a fourth state of matter, which is after gas. You heat even more. You start separate electrons and ions from the atoms, and that creates a plasma. So it's got nothing to do with the medical plasma, which you might have in mind when you hear the word plasma.
Right. Why are you now publishing climate-related research?
Oh, I've been working in climate for 12 years now. And that was just after my thesis, PhD thesis in plasma physics. I was just ready for another subject. I wanted to explore something else. And it turns out that in physical terms, atmospheric dynamics is, in a way, an application of fluid dynamics, and so is plasma physics. So the two fields aren't that different.
So let's get to that Guardian headline. What is the news about the ozone hole this year, Martin?
Yeah, so the ozone hole formed rather early. It's not the earliest in history, but it was quite early in particular because we're all hoping that this ozone hole is closing slowly. And so, it opened up early, and it developed into quite, you know, much bigger than it normally was in August. And since then, it came back a little for a few days, and then it's gone up again. And currently, it's not the largest we've ever seen, but it is the largest from, you know, the last few years, certainly. So it's just pretty large, and we expect it to grow more because it usually peaks around October, maybe November. So so it's going to grow more.
So this dangerous state of affairs in the upper atmosphere has not gone away. How could changes in the ozone hole affect sea ice formation around Antarctica?
Yeah, but the ozone itself, when it's there in the stratosphere, does that it blocks solar radiation. And in particular, why it's been so much concern for us humans is that it blocks ultraviolet radiation, which is very energetic and which is, of course, a health concern for us if that radiation reaches the surface. So normally that ozone is there and removes all of that radiation because in the chemical cycle of ozone, its life cycle, if you like, it consumes this radiation, it absorbs it. And when that ozone is not there, it reaches the surface. And so the link to sea ice, it is not a very clear link there, but what's happening is that all of this energy that now does hit the surface, and in particular the ozone hole is strongest over the pole and close to Antarctica. So all of that energy would hit not the ice, but the ocean water around the sea ice, or in which the sea ice, the icebergs are floating. And thus it could heat up the water, which then would melt more ice.
And this ozone hole is developing now, which in the southern hemisphere would be almost the beginning of spring, so that it's going to be fairly large when the sun is there, really there, almost 24 hours a day at some point.
Yes, no, that's correct. So by December, it will probably still be there, although then through more of the summer, our summer, as in January, February, the ozone hole disappears because there's different mechanisms. There's ozone being transported from elsewhere over where the ozone hole used to be. And one thing about the ozone hole is that in order to develop, it needs very low temperatures. And in summer, even up in the stratosphere, it's actually too warm. And so the hole closes again, and then it can open again the year after. But really the concern is this month of, end of November and December, when, of course, December is the solstice. So, yes, that's when the sun is strongest.
Now, you talk and work with other scientists, including Matthew England. What are people thinking is driving this sudden decline of Antarctic sea ice?
So there's a lot of people working on this. There are also, here in Australia, there's centers where many, many different scientists come together and work specifically on Antarctic science. So it's a big focus where a lot of people work on why currently the sea ice is so low. I guess the main reason is that the sea temperatures, so the oceans are so warm, and I'm sure everybody's seen those plots as well, with this year just being way off what any other year was. And of course, warm water melts the ice. You know that from your cocktail, right? You put ice in and you don't drink it immediately, the ice goes away, it melts. The main concern is really the warm waters, and why this year they are so high is actually a good question. I don't think anybody really knows why this year is so much warmer than the previous year, for example.
That is what I'm hearing from other scientists. Many are surprised and puzzled, and I'm sure there's a lot of analysis going on trying to find that out. Now, I want to talk for a little minute about the stratosphere and the troposphere. These are the two sort of layers that we designate in the atmosphere. And generally, there's a careful distinction between the two. And we've been told, weather happens in the troposphere, which is nearest to the surface here, but not really in the stratosphere. They operate on almost different rules. But are scientists discovering interaction, more interaction than we thought, between these two layers of the atmosphere?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's all correct. So the big difference is really what the temperature does as you go up into higher altitude. We all know that if you go up, if we hike up a mountain, or if you look at the temperature display in an airplane, the higher we go, the colder it gets. That's in the troposphere. But the distinction is made in the stratosphere is that the higher it gets, it actually gets warmer again. And that is exactly due to the ozone, which absorbs radiation and therefore warms up, and there's more ozone as you go higher up. And so that makes a big difference because it means that in the troposphere where it gets colder, you may know that warmer objects or warmer fluid, warmer air or warmer water is lighter than colder air or water. And so when it's warmer, it floats up. It's like a bubble in your lemonade. It floats up and it's warmer than the surroundings. So it floats up even more because as hot, when it gets higher, all its surroundings is getting cooler and cooler. And so that creates thunderstorms, for instance, and that creates what we call the weather in the troposphere. But in the stratosphere, if something rises, it's going to be cooler than its surroundings all the time because as it rises, the surrounding is warmer. And so it will sink back down because it's heavier than all its surroundings. So that's the big difference with the stratosphere. There is no thunderstorms, none of those thick clouds, no rain in the stratosphere because of that. And now, yes, you've mentioned, we discover more and more that these two layers, they used to be thought of as distinct because the processes that are happening are so different. But we now find that there's a lot of interaction between how the winds, how strong the winds are in the stratosphere, and that has implications how our surface weather behaves.
In 2021, you co-authored a paper about sudden stratospheric warming events in Antarctica. What are they, and can they affect ice melt or sea ice formation or anything lower down?
Yes, so sudden stratospheric warmings are exactly when the winds in the stratosphere, usually in the winter in the stratosphere, there are very strong winds, and we call this the polar vortex. That's up in the stratosphere. And when these winds, for various reasons, they can suddenly become much weaker or they can even reverse direction. And that's a sudden, we call this a sudden warming because this is always also accompanied with the temperature getting warmer. The winds get weaker, the temperatures get warmer. But that's only in the stratosphere. But it turns out that these events have strong impacts at the surface, and that's in both hemispheres. When the winds in the stratosphere in the winter get weaker, usually that means that the jet stream in the troposphere, so the strong winds which we also have in the troposphere, they shift towards the equator, and that would mean more cold snap, for instance, for continental America, or so the U.S., Canada, North America, that would mean we have a higher risk of cold snaps because the polar air can now come further southward than usual. And so in the southern hemisphere, the same thing happens. It's just that there's not so many continents and not so many people living where the most of the effect is, but we have the same shift, we have the same expansion of polar air towards the equator, and that has implications on sea ice as well because it means that the winds are different, so the sea ice, the floating sea ice is being blown into different directions, but it's also generally colder, so there will be less melting or even an expansion of sea ice when these events happen.
And yet that 2021 paper concludes there will be far fewer appearances of sudden stratospheric warming in Antarctica as the planet warms. They may be hundreds of years apart instead of 1 in 22 years, just as an example. So sudden stratospheric warming may not matter much anymore, at least at the South Pole.
Yes. So one caveat to that result is that what we used in that study is the same definition for the for Antarctica as we normally use for the North Pole, so for the Arctic. But there exist events, so these warmings, which are, and those are based on very strong events because they happen often enough in the Northern Hemisphere that we can concentrate only on the strongest of these events. But in the Southern Hemisphere, so what our paper showed was similarly strong events are basically a thing of the past. They're not going to happen anymore. But what different research from different groups around the world has shown is that in the southern hemisphere, we don't need such strong events to still have a surface impact. So we are now actually currently working on looking at how could we redefine these sudden warmings to detect events which still have an impact, but might actually, which we should expect to still happen in the future.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is scientist Dr. Martin Eucher from the University of New South Wales, Australia. Well, during the 2011 Fukushima nuclear power disaster, a camera caught Reactor 3 explode, and it blasted radioactive materials into the stratosphere, and that turned out to be very important. We learned radioactivity would stay up a longer time and fall back all over the Northern Hemisphere. So the key to a local event going global is reaching the stratosphere. And why is that, and how does that apply to that Tongan volcano eruption in January of 2022?
Yes, so what's important here is what I described as the difference between the stratosphere and the troposphere is that there's no weather, no storms, no rain in the stratosphere. So anything that goes gets blown into the troposphere, so the air close to the surface but stays there, will rather quickly be part of a storm, be in a cloud, and then be actually rained out. And it will, in such a way, will be removed rather quickly from the air because it will just fall down together with raindrops, or the strong winds will blow it somewhere else, and then it finally will end up in some rain event. But when it reaches the stratosphere, there is no rain, there is no thunderstorms, and so those particles, they're pretty light, so they're getting just, they can float for a long time, and if the winds are strong enough, which is the case in the stratosphere, they're getting distributed all over the globe, just as you mentioned before. And then they will slowly, again, because they're so light, they will eventually fall down due to gravity, but that will take a long time because they're so light and small, and there's no raindrops which would drag them down. And the same thing happened with the Hunga Tonga eruption in January 2022, when a lot of not radioactive material this time, but water vapor was injected into the stratosphere. That water came from the ocean water above the volcano, because the volcano erupted underwater. That was just evaporating all the water. It was just steam, an enormous cloud of hot steam which reached the stratosphere. And that water is still in the stratosphere, and we expect it to impact surface climate for 7 to 8 years.
Well, it's so weird because we expect volcanic eruptions to cool the planet a little, but now this eruption is considered a warming influence by some.
So this volcano is very special because in a normal volcano, you would have lots of smoke as well, and you would have sulfur in particular. You would smell of rotten eggs. And that smoke and sulfur, that actually acts to reflect solar radiation when it's in the atmosphere. And so you would have a cooling effect. But now this volcano had almost no sulfur or no smoke because it was an underwater volcano. And in turn, it had a lot of water vapor. And now water vapor is the strongest greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. And this is why we could expect or might expect a warming at the surface due to this volcano rather than a cooling, simply because what's been blown into the stratosphere is a greenhouse gas.
Well, let's peek into another of your new co-authored papers. And here we learn that there are, in fact, maybe they're light, but there are some clouds in the stratosphere. Published March 13, 2023, the title is Can Polar Stratospheric Clouds Explain Arctic Amplification? And I tuned right in when you suggested connections between increasing methane in the atmosphere, and it certainly is increasing, to very high polar clouds, and then that somehow feeds back to extra warming in the Arctic. Could you please draw us that map of how that works?
Yes. So while there is no rain in the stratosphere, it is true that in the winter over the pole, there are clouds forming, but these are not clouds that we see. They are so thin that even if they're there and we look up at the sky, we don't see them. And they're formed from ice particles. So the fact that they're thin, that we can't see them, means that sunlight can just go through them. It doesn't interact anything. It isn't reflected or anything. But what happens is that these ice particles of those polar stratospheric clouds, they do interact with long-wave radiation, which comes back from the surface. And so they do block the radiation that comes back from the surface due to the temperature of the surface. It blocks that, and that's exactly the greenhouse effect. So that's exactly the same thing with carbon dioxide, with water vapor, but this time with these ice crystals from those polar stratospheric clouds. So they can, and that's been known for a while, they can have an effect. But so far, we thought that that effect is so small that we don't have to care about it, because there's not many of those clouds, and they're only there in winter. And so what our research was trying to explore was, well, in particular in past climates, so very long time ago, we don't know how much methane there was in the atmosphere, but we think it was a lot more than was now. And so we ran climate model which can deal with the chemistry and the clouds and radiation, and increased methane within the range that we think it could have been. And we found that if there's enough methane, we suddenly start producing a lot more of these polar stratospheric clouds, and therefore we have a larger greenhouse effect of these clouds, and that could contribute to polar amplification.
Okay, now I want to just jag over to another thing here, and I don't know whether you have an answer to this or not, but let's give it a shot. A listener sent me an article written by two Norwegian scientists, and among other concerns, they warn that solar storms causes the ionosphere to precipitate electrons, which then fall as electron precipitation, or EEP, and that increases nitrogen dioxide, damaging the ozone layer, they say. So we are reaching the peak of the sun's 11-year cycle. Martin, you have expertise on this. Do you think changes in solar activity are a factor in this year's ozone hole, or even in the extreme heat that's popping up around the world?
So, yeah, it is not my center of expertise, but I do not think that this... I think it's a question of order of magnitude. I'm certain that solar storms interact with the Earth's ionosphere. This is the whole reason why we see Arctic lights, or how they're called, auroras. That's the ionosphere interacting with solar wind, as we call it, so or storms from the sun. And those electrons, they can fly around, they can have effect on nitrogen. But what we see this year in terms of ozone hole has actually been predicted quite accurately simply by including the effect of the Hanga Tonga volcano, which we discussed before. And the reason there is that more water vapor in the stratosphere means also more ozone destruction. And that's due to how the ozone chemistry works. And so for this year's ozone hole, we have actually expected this to become very big this year because of that volcano. And that is enough of an explanation for why this ozone hole is so big. So, and then the ozone hole has a really minor effect on global temperatures, in particular in the northern hemisphere where we had the heat wave. The ozone hole is over the South Pole. The heat waves were in the northern hemisphere summer, far on the other side of the globe, basically. So I don't think we should link that solar activity to current warm global temperatures and the heat waves the northern hemisphere has experienced.
Okay, well, we've tried to cover a lot here. Martin, what are you working on next?
Next, I am working on trying to find out how storms, not thunderstorms, but large storms which bring flooding, how they might change, if at all, in the future, in order to try and be prepared for possibly more extensive flooding, in particular in Australia.
That's a big question. And here we're seeing all these floods in Turkey and Greece and Bulgaria and in South America. We saw them in China earlier this year, Japan. So it's definitely becoming a global phenomenon. We'll look forward to that research from the Climate Change Research Center at the University of New South Wales. We've been speaking with Dr. Martin Eucher. You can find links to the science we just talked about in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Martin, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
This year of 2023 has been a revelation for all of us, scientists included. Just as we thought to comprehend how the world works, surprises jolt our understanding. Why did Earth rapidly lose its solar shield in the Antarctic sea ice? Why did we take such a sharp jump in temperatures, not just in the Northern Hemisphere in the summer, but in the Southern winter as well? Why the big storms that are flooding city streets across the globe? Why is it starting to rain in Antarctica? Why is the great conveyor belt of ocean currents weakening? These things have experts guessing, testing new theories they are applying for grant money to find out. The rest of us are just reeling from repeated blows of record extreme weather. Some scientists, like Michael Mann at Penn State, suggests we do know why. The cause is global warming, built up from decades of fossil-powered emissions and deforestation. Others calculated all that and never came up with the extreme changes in events seen this year. They try to add a little for solar activity, a bit for ship pollution cuts, maybe extra methane from bogs and beaver ponds. Even all that doesn't give you record-smashing heat waves around the world, instant Cat 5 hurricanes, and destabilized glaciers in such a short period of time. All the best models and minds did not predict this, and now things are shifting so rapidly, maybe we can't predict what comes next. The prediction system is broken, and that could be as dangerous as the threat of nuclear war. We failed to plan for the known. Now we can hardly plan for the unknown, except maybe to duck down into a minimum footprint with a fallback position and manual backups for everything. What is pushing us into a dangerous new state so fast? We do not know, and we may not find out in time. As Naomi Klein would say, this changes everything. But there is still the joy of trying to discover all the amazing things on this planet and in this universe. For example, we heard Martin Eucher was trained in plasma physics. It blows my mind trying to understand plasma. I had to look it up again. We learn there's a fourth state of matter beyond solid, liquid, and gas. Plasma is 99.9% of visible matter in this universe, and the public knows practically nothing about it. Of course, we seldom experience it. The precession of matter is the story of heat, with heat being the energy or motion within the molecules and atoms. The lowest form of energy, almost frozen in space and time, are the solids from rocks to tree bark. Most solids, if you heat them enough, go into a liquid state. We see that when ice melts, but rocks too become liquid with the heat of volcanoes. Add a lot more heat to those liquids, and they dissipate into a gas form. Even metals can have a gas state. Their molecules and atoms float in the atmosphere. That is about as far up the ladder of heat humans can ever experience. But with enormous amounts of heat or energy, like the atomic fusion on our sun, atoms break up. Electrons can break free of the nucleus to form a kind of fog of particles. That is plasma. But these hard planets are lonely exceptions in a universe mostly containing fields of plasma mixed with cold space. There is hardly anything solid out there. Our situation on a rock in this solar system racing through space is extremely rare and perhaps unique. That is another reason why we should honor it. and learn to live in harmony with all other life on our planetary home. With Wonder for the Universe, I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.